Welcome to Security.com, the podcast, where we're bringing together in-depth intel, real talk, and the human side of cybersecurity. So we're recording from Hacker Summer Camp here in Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm your host, Dan Mellinger, and each episode I'll be joined by industry experts, defenders, and voices from the front lines to explore the latest enterprise security insights straight from the pages of security.com and the mind shaping the field. Today we're talking to the team that invented risk-based vulnerability management and decision-making for that matter, Ed Bellis, CEO, Michael Reutman, CTO, and Jay Jacobs, the Chief Data Scientist at Empirical Security. So I, just in case people don't know this, we all work together many years now, but work together at Kenneth Security. You guys basically founded the company together, and the prioritization to prediction research series where you really just drilled into risk-based vulnerability management and kind of the data science behind all that. So I figured we'd kick off with some context here. So Ed, Michael, reflecting on Kenneth Security, you guys started that to really drive data into the decision-making process for cybersecurity and vulnerability remediation. So what were some of the key inflection points of building that out, and how does that kind of translate to what you guys are doing now?
Sure, yeah, I'll start. So when we first started what ultimately became Kenneth Security, right, you're right, we were trying to take a risk-based approach to remediation around vulnerability management. So prior to founding Kenna, I was the CISO at Orbitz, the online travel company, where I was running into this problem on a day-to-day basis, right? We had way too many vulnerabilities. We couldn't possibly fix all of them. Did we need to? How do we make these decisions? There wasn't a whole lot out there. In fact, I remember back in those days talking to a number of people, and a lot of the complaints, believe it or not, back then was there's just not enough data, right? And if you talk about to these guys now today, it's completely the opposite. But one of the things that we did have was a lot of noise coming from those vulnerability scanners, right? So went out and we are taking this approach of let's take a data-driven approach, which was somewhat novel back then, right? I mean, there was some other companies, some other people that were talking about taking data decision-making processes within security, but it was still pretty rare. There's a whole lot of gut feel out there. Frankly, there's still a whole lot of gut feel out there.
Cybersecurity is very much an art, and then sometimes a science.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's got, you know, I will say it's gotten a lot better. Right? Yep. Over the last 15 years, it's gotten a heck of a lot better. So we started running into inflection points really early on, right? So for us, it was, we knew we needed to take a data-driven approach to this. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know how at the time, right? So we were just kind of learning along the way with a lot of our customers, and we kind of frankly ran into some things accidentally. Michael and I were at an RSA conference many years ago and sat down and talked at the time with Roger Thornton, who was the CTO of Alien Vault. And he's like, oh yeah, we're working on this little thing, the Open Threat Exchange. And as part of it, we're kind of collecting all of this data from all of the different SIMs that we have deployed around the world. And it turns out, you know, some of that data is attack data, and we think that vulnerabilities might be a part of that. Would you guys be interested in working with that data? Yeah, that sounds interesting to us. Yeah, absolutely. So we started getting into it, and it's like, oh yeah, there's actually quite a bit of starting to see telemetry of attacks and signatures matching against vulnerabilities and things like that. And so that seems like a helpful first step in the prioritization process. Well, it turned out later, because Roger ended up being on our board, I was nice. Talking to him after a board meeting, he goes, oh yeah, that's not just attack data, that's actually successful exploitation data, because we also sit on the asset and we know what vulnerabilities they have, and we have the IOCs post the attack to say that that was actually successful. And I was like, that's even way more interesting, right? So there was a lot of stuff that became that we ran into almost by accident, but it was the early days of kind of how do we use things that are actually happening on the real world to prioritize your own remediation.
And to be clear, that data basically was generally, you don't see that unless you're the company or maybe an MSP, and you're able to track the exploitation, so external, into the vulnerability that they actually exploited, and then verify that it was an event that happened at this company.
That's right.
People have a hard time attributing today. So, okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah, and there's still, I mean, frankly, that whole full chain, there's not a ton of that out there. Mm-hmm. There is, but there's a lot of pieces of that everywhere, right?
Interesting.
I'd say that was the first inflection point I thought of too. But the reason it was really useful from a data science perspective is we realized we had an outcome measure now, mm-hmm. and we can start to build models against it. That began our journey of collecting that type of data about attack telemetry tied to CVEs, and we started talking to vendors about whether they had it. We started using it as a filter for whether we would want to acquire their data or not. In some cases, we even asked vendors to build custom feeds for that kind of data, which I think the other inflection point was EPSS, where we realized that some of the data we're using to build these reports at Kenna and the product itself could be useful in an open sense as well, as long as we didn't expose the data itself.
Interesting. And EPSS is the Exploit Prediction Scoring System, which was created by these two guys right here and still chaired, right? You're yep. still the chair of the yep, EPSS first SIG. So. Yep. Sounds like a good kind of segue into maybe give a little background on some of these, global models, right?
So I think it started with the P2P V1, the Prediction and Prioritization Volume 1. We were working on that data, and we built a very simple model. In hindsight, I should say, it was a very simple model.
Yeah. It seems so advanced.
Then it was like cutting edge.
But that was almost 10 years ago.
No.
Wow.
2018.
Anyway, that's just terrible. Anyway, but 10 years ago, we built this very simple model. And I think we were looking at exploit code being published and exploitation in the wild. And that was our outcome variable for that one. But we found that we could build a really, really relatively good predictive model with relatively little data. And that started down this journey, saying, what other data can we get? How can we make this better? What data is going to be, informative of this? And that led to the first version of EPSS, which I think had 16 variables. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking like CVSS, where someone could grab these 16 variables, look, go find the data, fill them out, and we gave them the math formula, and they would come out with a probability. And that was V1, and that was shortly after the V1 of the Prioritization and Prediction series.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. And I think important context, right? At this time, you'd use a vulnerability scanner, right? You'd go scan your environment or a subset of the environment, and you get this report that if you printed it out, was, this boof, right, dropped on the desk. And it was a list of kind of assets, maybe the software and the vulnerabilities that was on there. And they were generally ranked by CVSS, right? Which is a measure of severity. So if a vulnerability can be accessed by remote code, right? It's gonna be a 9+ generally, especially at this time, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean it's gonna be exploited, right? It could be a correlating factor, but people are prioritizing off of severity because if bad thing bad, get rid of bad thing. But when there's,
but when almost everything is bad
yeah. things, right? Yeah. And I think that was the biggest one. It was safer at the time, a lot of times, to bias the data to be a higher severity score, where we were seeing, I think the big part of it was a very low exploitation predictive occurrence, right?
So this is the other inflection point. It's that at some point, the number of vulnerabilities published and detected at organizations stopped being a human scale problem and became a machine scale problem. I think this happened probably before you started Kenna, because you felt the pain as a CISO.
Yeah, 100.
But it really cemented at a lot of organizations, because I remember 15 years ago, you would go into a large enterprise, they were scanning 500 assets. That's no longer the case. Every large enterprise scans
Everything. Tens
of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of assets. Yeah. And so when you look at that problem and 300,000 CVEs out there, it's no longer okay to say it's bad, I gotta get rid, like it seems bad, I gotta get rid of it. Now you have to have a targeted, calculated strategy. To answer your original question, which was what were the Kenna inflection points, I think for me, it was when we saw that we had more IT users than security users in the platform. And we realized that we were catering to the security team, helping them make decisions. But the problem we were solving was actually an IT remediation capacity problem. And that completely changed how I thought about the whole space.
That's interesting. Well, and I think, too, taking that global perspective, kind of bringing it around with what you guys are working on today, right? What are kind of the benefits of having these global models, but like where do they fall short too, right? I think that's the big challenge, right?
You want to take that or?
Yeah, sure. I mean, global models is the state of the art across, I would say, a lot of SaaS, not even security. It's a part of it is that SaaS, as in general, as a way to deliver software, has had this promise of a net effect, which is you learn from every customer, and so it makes the product better. And you know, in the case of some SaaS, that's probably true, where the product gets better, the algorithm gets better. For security in general, I think that was a red herring. So what we thought was that if you built a platform and you scanned 50 different organizations, then the model that you would build would get better and more efficient across the 50 organizations if you fed all that data in. But each organization is pretty unique, and each organization's environment is pretty dynamic in different ways. So if you think about a pharmaceutical company versus an insurance company versus a bank versus a retailer versus a large enterprise or a small enterprise or a multinational corporation, the IT infrastructure footprints of those are wildly different. So are the threats, so are the problems, so are the technologies that they use. Mm-hmm. And building a generalized model across all of them falls short for each individual one. We learned that when we would go into customer deployments and they would say, well, that's great that you've built this predictive model. I'd like that's, you know, better than me just guessing. Mm-hmm. But my environment is unique. I've got this kind of infrastructure you're not accounting for. I've got a special threat. I consume this data from FSISAC that I want you to account for. Can you retrain the model for me? And in 2020, the answer was no. There's not enough data scientists, not enough compute, not enough infrastructure to do that. I think in 2025, the answer is let's try.
Yeah. And I'd add to that, right? So even now at Empirical, and we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what it is that we're doing, but on these environments, they're not only unique in the sense that I'm in this industry or I'm a member of FSISAC, or that, they even have unique environments within the company, right? So it's like This company or this area, it's heavily IoT, the global data that you would look at a global level, there's very little data out there that's going to tell them about what it is that they should prioritize on this infrastructure of networked cameras, right?
Right. So
you really need the local context to really be able to understand that.
And the whole, like, the outcome measure of this, like, if we take a step back just to reorient everyone, is the goal is to highlight and prioritize functionally the security actions, or maybe IT actions in a lot of cases, that folks can take that will do the most to help their security posture, right? That's kind of the end goal. So if you can, you know, the most important things that are likely to be hit first, you want to take care of those first and work your way down the list as capacity allows. But that challenge is even more so a machine scale issue today with AI and LLM based, I mean, even phishing automation on the bad guy side, right?
Well, if you think about where we are, Hacker Summer Camp, mm-hmm. there's a lot of innovation happening on the detection and response side, mm-hmm. using AI tools to try to automate triage and resolve alerts and investigate alerts.
Yeah, add context and so humans can go take action. Right?
Those are great mm-hmm. products that exist because the problem on the detection and response side is machine scale. Yeah. It's no longer human scale. There's not enough SOC analysts to go to through every alert. But in reality, security is split into two. It's split into detect everything that's happening and classify it as malicious or not, and do things to prevent the malicious events from happening. It kind of follows that if the alerts are not human scale, neither is the way to measure the preventative actions. So you want to decide, is this a good action to take or not, based on the alerts that you would be preventing. If they're not human scale, then you need essentially ML models, AI models to solve the preventative question as well.
Oh, you know, that's interesting because I never tied that together. On the preventative side, you need to make, it's necessary to make predictions. And I think we were talking about CVSS earlier, right? That's where that all stopped, because it was like this kind of, now it's semi-static, right? It was fully static back in the day. But a semi-static measure of like this thing bad or this thing badder relative to other things, right? But maybe break down, like, how does the predictive element of EPSS, that kind of changed things. A lot of companies are using that to standardize. How was that a jump up from the previous models?
Well, one of the things that we realized as we were collecting data early on was that the data shifted daily. You know, so like some a vulnerability may be announced, and especially in the first few weeks, you know, like NVD may not have enriched it. Now it may never enrich them, but getting off track on that one. But you know, like you'd get new data every day. And sometimes, you know, you'd see exploit code being added into Metasploit, which is a huge predictor. And then all of a sudden that didn't work and it gets pulled out or something, you know. But like, as an analyst, you would want to have your pulse on all of that. You'd want to say, oh, wait a minute, this changed. Like, now we have this new information. We know this new thing. We need to react to it. I mean, just intuitively, that's what you need to do to problems. You work with the information you have right now, and when it updates, you may have a different decision. And that's exactly what EPSS was doing. By getting the data daily and we're seeing those changes, we have to update that score, and we'll update it daily if something changes. And we have to have that reaction. So it's just, it's not like it's a brand new thing. We're sort of mirroring what people do. When you get new information, you react and you make something different, make a different decision.
Doing it at machine scale. Right?
At machine scale, yeah.
Well, that's another interesting piece too. I guess asking you guys, if you had to guess the delta between, say, a global model and using that to help reduce, you acted on that as your main metric to go do remediation, right? Versus the delta of having local models.
Yeah. I want to extend what Michael was talking about earlier. And I think, you know, early on, everyone started with local models, you know, and they were like, here's our environment, and we're going to develop this risk measurement tool, and they were generally pretty basic.
And we've seen some, like, in spreadsheets calculators.
EPSS, let's be fair. Version 1, we built a calculator for
it. Right? There was one in an Excel file. Yeah. I forgot about that. I have seen that.
Anyway, it was a goal to make V1 implementable
and accessible. Yeah, that's right.
But anyway, but that was a local model, and then you moved to global models, and I think we saw an improvement. And I think what we want to do now is start with that global model approach and bring it back to local. So essentially, a lot of companies, the global is going to be pretty good, and really we just need to tweak the tail, you know, the tail of that distribution. There's going to be things on that tail in a local model that's going to be really, really important, you know.
I'm going to coin this term. People live on the tail, though.
Yeah.
We also
risk
learned,
is at the tail.
We learned that at the average enterprise will remediate about 15% of their vulnerabilities on average. Which means that half of them are doing less than 15% a month, which means that initial part of remediation, that capacity, is where you want your model to perform best. Mm-hmm. So people live on the tail. If you've got an increase of efficiency in the first 5% of your capacity, that's actually more valuable that an increase of efficiency at the bottom 50% of your capacity, because you might never remediate 50% of your vulns.
Well, and also just think of the raw numbers. Like, you talked about the number of vulns that an organization is experiencing, and in some cases they have millions of assets and hundreds of millions of vulnerabilities, right? Yeah. A percentage point matters a lot.
A lot, right? Well, and 15% on average remediation, that's a lot.
That's a lot. That's a lot of remediation.
When you think about that.
But that also means there's a lot of open vulnerabilities out there, right?
Explain living on the long tail. I think you're referring to, right, there's the chance of something happening, and then it's just over time, there's a very low percentage, but a very long likelihood, right, something occurring.
A really easy way to describe that is that, you know, you look at this, your corporate environment where you could have possibly hundreds of millions of vulnerabilities, you really only care about that one. You know, that one that is going to cause the next major thing, that's the one you care about, but you have to be able to pick that out of the enormous haystack that you're sitting at. And that's on the tail. Right, you have to figure out that's what you're shooting. You're shooting after that little one thing that's going to cause a huge problem.
Low likelihood, massive impact.
Right. Yeah.
That's almost all of security. It's looking for rare events and trying to predict them ahead.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, when you look at just even EPSS and the EPSS scores, right? And if you're just looking at the raw score, the likelihood of an exploitation somewhere on the internet, it's actually quite low for almost every vuln out there, right? Because that doesn't happen a lot, right?
A lot of it's theoretical or too hard to implement, right?
Like another example, if you look at losses from breach events, I think the median, the latest Santi report, I think was 200, 300,000. Mm-hmm. The median loss from a cybersecurity breach event. was around that amount. And that is, I don't even know if a budget for any security group is at anywhere near that low.
Yeah, but what's the cost per record, Jay?
But then, I mean, like, that is the median. And
does
nobody,
this podcast allow inside jokes? Or should we explain that?
If they figure it out, it's an outside joke now.
But nobody, trying to gloss over that whole thing, but nobody will you know, manage their risk to that median. They care about the 95th percentile, the 99th percentile. They want to look at the tail risk, because that's the stuff that's really going to hurt. And as you get up into that upper range, you are no longer in the hundreds of thousands. Then you're talking millions and millions of dollars losses. So that people manage risk at the tail, not at the whole distribution.
And so how is combining this local modeling with this global?
So the global's going to get, you know, we're going to have this global perspective where you're getting all this information, but then you look at a company like Mike was saying, hey, we've got this other data source that's giving us a little extra, or we know that our assets look like this, and we know these things are internet facing, or they're in this environment, or OT environment is running this technology. These little tidbits are going to be able to nudge that global model and help expose that tail a little bit easier, a little bit more obvious to say, whoa, wait a second, like, the global model is saying this, but the way that you have your network configured, the way you have these compensating controls put in there and the things that you're running, here's your priority. Like this, and when you structuring it like this, what we're finding is, like, it's almost obvious. Like, the tail is sort of swinging around and hitting people in the head, like when you're looking at it, which is terrible. Sorry. But, you know, there's a lot of, when you're looking at the data and you're looking at all these things together as a big picture, you can see these things. And that's what I think we're going to find, is that as we're going from that global to a local, there's this little, just these little things pop out, and it's going to be like, whoa, like, that's important. Like, the global didn't say that, but there's these little bits.
I know, you know, it's funny, I know exactly what you, so we worked on prioritization to prediction series. It was, we ended up doing, I think,
nine volumes
annually, and then, well, kind of biannually, but either way, we pulled on this vulnerability remediation data science thread ultimately and went very, very deep down the rabbit hole. But the fun part of that was when you guys would be crunching the data, and Jay was, you know, right, doing that. And the first step would be kind of review some of the stuff. And the coolest part about that work was when you'd give us a draft of the data and we'd look at it, and everyone would be like, holy shit, like, they're like, this is a crazy insight, and it makes so much sense, and it's actually intuitive, and it's kind of, feel dumb that we didn't think about this before. But it was like, if you think about a eureka moment, it, like, we were having those. And that's kind of, I think that's what you're talking about, right? When you start modeling for these companies, you're starting to find the things that, like, oh, no shit, you should have been doing this all along. And they're like, oh, we didn't even think about that.
Tying it back together to the conversation with Roger Thornton, I don't know, 10 years ago, the reason that we looked at that data and we're like, whoa, this is an outcome measure for our models, we can actually start to be more data-driven about it, is essentially because Alien Vault at the time was looking at SIM data, IDS data, and scan data on the same assets. So they were doing the data engineering correlation kind of by happenstance, because they were packaging these products together. So they lived in the same environment. But now, I think what we're trying to do with the local models is look at detection telemetry, you know, preventative technologies, asset assessments, all the configuration data, cloud data, all together to see if those insights start to pop out at a local scale. We had an example with a design partner recently where we essentially just combined two data sets. This was pre-modeling, and we showed them that there was a correlation that they had not seen before because the detection team had not talked to the preventative team.
Which,
and when they
happens
saw
a lot, right? Yeah. Like, a lot of these tooling and teams even operate in silos, right?
So Jay broke the silo, and they were like, oh, we got to go. Let's talk next week.
That's a good point. And the other thing that we see at the local model level that we frankly just can't even see at the global model level is, at the global model level, is all about CVEs, right? Because there's ground truth data out there about exploitations of CVEs.
And CVEs is common vulnerabilities and exposures, so it's a vulnerability.
Yes. However, there's a lot of weaknesses that are not CVEs, right? So misconfigurations, some cloud security issues, some application security issues. These are all things that are unique to an application, an org, something like that, that they have telemetry at that local level that you can't collect at the global level that's meaningful, right? So
default creds, right?
Yeah, you end up seeing that stuff that's coming in through, you know, there are various data sources on the detection and response side of the house that think, aha, this is actually very relevant to your weaknesses, right? So we can do stuff like that as well.
What even is a global model for applications? Like, what's a global? There's no such thing as a global application. They're all unique.
Yeah,
that's
right. They do different things by definition.
Well, and even trying to track vulnerabilities it's gone almost nowhere, right, in 10 years. So interesting. What's changed in the landscape now to enable y'all to be able to correlate this kind of data at scale?
Well, okay. The infrastructure for data engineering has changed. The infrastructure for data science has changed. I think a lot of people point to LLMs as the thing that's changed in security, and so everybody prepends AI to their name, and some of that is a valuable tool that can do text summarization, triage. But the more valuable part is that the reason that the LLM foundational companies are able to train models that are so big and so massive is that the infrastructure for training models has gotten better. Yeah. So if you want to train a smaller model that's good at a specific task, there are operations platforms to do that. There are cloud native platforms where you can store data in different formats and augment it and look at the chain of custody for that data and the chain of cleanliness for that data that didn't exist 10 years ago. So that same infrastructure that people are very excited about, the AI buzzword, is also very useful for training really specific models for solving the security issues that people have and for correlating the data, frankly, that before might have been too unique of a problem to an individual customer. Yeah. Another thing that's changed is I used to talk to a lot of security data scientists, people at organizations who might not have been data scientists to start with, who were doing exploratory data analysis, who were trying to build some kind of statistical model inside of a security organization. Those jobs are becoming really hard to fill because there's a huge boom in data science and machine learning and AI in general that's revenue generating, right? Yeah. Go work on a chatbot that pays three times as much as being a security data scientist. So there's a lot of data that's been collected at security organizations, and a lot of the insight was promised in the future, but is becoming harder to get.
Interesting. So a brain drain on a lot of these data science roles because Mark Zuckerberg's offering them $1 billion or
yes,
whatever.
Yes, he is.
Well, I mean, we compete against Mark Zuckerberg offering people $1 billion. We got to hire data scientists too, right?
Yeah.
It's a real thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, and so it sounds like there's a lot more of the tooling available, system processes, and somewhat people.
there are a lot more people who work in data science. Don't get me wrong, right? There's whole schools of data science now.
But the demand is now much greater than the supply.
Money's elsewhere, right? Yeah. The money's on the AI fun stuff versus the security stuff that actually enables. It is, and it enables all the fun stuff.
That's what we tell
Jay
every day. You're having fun. Don't worry about anything else.
Yeah, you're having fun. Well, I think actually that's a good point. Like, how do you guys position Empirical in a market that is literally, like, if you go walk the floor, everyone's like, we're AI-enabled because we layered an LLM on top of our
there is a lot of
documentation,
that.
Right? Yeah. Like, how do you guys differentiate Empirical
this landscape? I'll start on this, and then I'll let the smarter people correct me and do better. One of the things that we're really big about here is, you know, we talk about models. And it's really right model for the job, right? Yeah. Or right tool for the job. And there are times where this model performs best for this individual task. Mm-hmm. And for this task over here, you need a different type of model. It's not, let's just apply an LLM to everything and see what, you know, OpenAI spits back out at us on this, right? So we talk a lot about the global model and the local model, but it's really an ensemble of models, each of them, and they're all doing different individual tasks, and some of them are different types of models to do those tasks that perform the best. And you might actually have some where a model goes in, you might have a large language model that goes in and does something like label data, right? And then that feeds into another model that makes a prediction on something. So it's always right tool for the job for us.
Okay.
But I'll let these.
Yeah, LLMs are a very specific tool in the toolbox. Mm-hmm. And they are not great at, I mean, they're great at large language models. They're great at language.
Yeah, they're predicting what next word comes after
these
three,
and,
right?
But like, you know, if you ask it to try and judge risk or to give you an answer or something, you know, like they seem much more willing to placate whoever is typing into them or whatever.
Don't use ChatGPT as your therapist or girlfriend or boyfriend for that matter.
Okay, this isn't therapy.com, this is security.com.
Yeah.
And so like you want to use LLMs for what they're good for. And then stop using them because they're no longer good at other things. So when you talk about trying to predict an exploit, that's a very specific thing and you've got very specific data sets. You don't want to try and feed all that into an LLM and say, hey, LLM, give me a good predictive output. That's not a great way to treat those.
Well, first of all, they're not predictive. They're predictive of words, not words. Predictive of right. events, which is what we're trying to predict.
I think I saw someone posted. Did you guys do like an analysis of trying to like get ChatGPT commercial
this
LLMs?
This was kind of a gimmick. To be honest.
Kind of a straw man.
Yeah. I don't think Jay liked it too much.
I didn't like it too much.
Jay's very rigorous around ethical, moral research and disclosures.
So to do that, we build an agent called JPT to replace Jay. So we did this, right? We ran the experiment what would it look like.
Can I talk to JPT?
Yes. You can. It's available on GitHub under MIT license. It is free and open to the public.
Everyone can have JPT for themselves.
Everybody can have JPT. Yeah. I think 4 people have started their repository so far.
Nice. Wow.
One of them is me. So we did this essentially as a thought experiment, but it also helps us establish a benchmark. So we built an agent that essentially queries the internet for information about vulnerabilities and then makes a judgment call about a probability of exploitation in the next 30 days. And we used OpenRouter, so we ran it through an OpenAI model, a Google model, and an Anthropic model. Cheap ones, because it's expensive.
Yeah.
We ran a sample of 50,000 vulnerabilities stratified by both EPSS score and exploitation activity. Okay. And so this is, and we published that data set too. Everybody can use it, take a look at it.
Yeah.
So what we wanted to do is we wanted to see if you just ask the model and give it some access to the internet to judge a vulnerability, how would it perform? And then we measured that on the efficiency coverage chart.
Yeah.
Essentially, we tried to see how well it performed against EPSS, how well it performed against our model.
And efficiency and coverage. Well, maybe explain that real quick.
Well, let's
please, someone else do it.
I'll do it.
Ed.
All right, so I did this for every P2P report, I felt like, in the end. But efficiency and coverage, for those who are deep into data science, right, it's precision and recall that we've effectively renamed for the security audience because it makes more sense from a security standpoint. Yeah. But you can think of coverage and efficiency as coverage is, let's say there are 100 vulnerabilities out there that have exploitation activity for them. How many of those did I fix? So if I fixed 80 out of 100, I have 80% coverage of my exploited vulnerabilities. Efficiency is the opposite of that. I went out and fixed 100. How many of them were actually had exploitation activity associated with them? So if I went and fixed 120 of them were, then I had 20% efficiency. One of the things, so this goes back to our days at Kenna, right? We would often see customers come in as they were starting to take this risk-based approach to vuln management. And they would start with efficiency as their most important metric.
It's important to point out there's trade-offs between
going
for efficiency or coverage, right? Hitting everything, a lot of work, hitting the things that really matter the most, least work, hopefully the most targeted, but the long 1%, right? You're living on the long tail.
That's right. And so they would start with efficiency because they wanted to make sure they got a big bang for their buck, right? Everything that we do needs to matter so that we can drive down risk quickly. With the resources we have. Sure. But over time, as they matured and they started to build things out, they started to care more about coverage. I want to make sure that I get everything out there that could that's likely to be exploited or is exploited, right? So it was almost like a maturity curve that they followed as well. But that's essentially what it is. And to your point, there's trade-offs as you get more, especially since it's really a prediction, right? You're predicting that you're going to be exploited or not exploited in the future by this particular vulnerability. By fixing it, it's an unknown at the time, and then we'll measure that 30 days out, 60 days out, 90 days out, whatever that is. And so to get to a certain point, you either got to fix a lot of vulnerabilities to get the coverage that you want, or you need to be very precise with what you are fixing to make sure that you have really good precision or efficiency.
So one way to think about a model and how good a model is how much does it minimize your trade-off between efficiency and coverage.
Split the difference, right?
Right.
Yeah.
A good model is essentially telling you can stay efficient as your coverage grows because this model is very good at predictions. Mm-hmm. That's essentially the reason why that happens. So what we found by looking at the LLMs and comparing them to EPSS was that they perform much worse at every coverage level. And what's even worse than that is to run the predictions for those 50,000 vulnerabilities hourly for a day, to run it for all CVEs hourly for a day, would have cost us $288,000. And these are cheap models through OpenRouter, which like gives bulk discounts, versus a tool that is designed with classical machine learning, better data sets input, isn't obfuscated by the large transformers trained on language, doing the same exact task can do it for $5.
And much better.
Got it. It's like the difference between trying to do compute via a CPU or a GPU, right? Like,
it's exactly right. That's actually a really good analogy.
So, okay. That makes sense. It's way more expensive. The results sucked more and weren't nearly as good.
It can do it.
And it was kind of a gimmick. But to be fair, if anyone was going to do this test, and I trust you guys to do it, and they released the data,
well,
so you could see.
One of the reasons of Strawman is that you can put a lot of effort into building up LLMs and to, you know, feeding in all this data and tuning it and fine-tuning it and all sorts of stuff. And we didn't really do a ton of that, but we did a little bit and we threw that stuff in there. But I think if I were going to do that for real, I would put a lot more effort into it.
And we hope that somebody does.
Yeah.
Our hypothesis is that that will be very expensive and still underperforming.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I mean, like way underperforming, right?
Yeah.
Well,
and that's the thing, right? We already know, I would say, right now, as long as money is not an issue, which, I mean, in the landscape, sometimes that's kind of the case for a little bit, then maybe you want to go that route. But as of today, right, that doesn't seem like a very viable strategy. Actually, I heard a story, interesting enough, about how they, you know, this is actually rampant where people are using LLMs internally to do stuff, and you got to track it because a lot of people are spending a lot of money. And I heard a story about they were auditing token usage, and one of the engineers was just burning through like $4,000 a day because they were like, write this code. And then when it did it wrong, it's like, no, that's not right. And it was
great
just
guidance.
They weren't tuning their model. They were just, you know, not giving it anything else. So interesting. And you guys kind of touched on this as well, but what are some of the, I guess, use cases beyond vulnerability prioritization for something like this, right? You talked about like misconfigs and things like that, which generally policy EDR side of things, but.
I mean, I can start. It definitely starts with like the, whether it's misconfig or cloud security or application security. The way I like to think of it is I always, to simplify it for my mind, I divide security into two sides of the house, right? There's the detection and response side of the house where the SOC lives, a lot of the tooling over there is, a lot of the alerting is, and then there's the kind of predict and prevent, the hygiene side of the house of, here's all the things that we got to do so that we deal with less of the stuff on the detection and response side of the house. However, you need all of that data to kind of feed in and have that kind of virtuous cycle. Yeah. Everything on the left half for me is like fair game, right? In terms of building models to, I want to be able to predict things in advance, be proactive about them so that I don't have to deal with them on the detection and response side of the house, right? And so anything that you can think of where I am in some way increasing my security or lowering my future risk over here on the left side of the house, I believe that we should be able to build models for those and be able to test that over time and be able to get better about, you know, now I'm being proactive, but fixing the things that are most likely gonna cause some sort of incident or issue over here.
There's a J. Jacobs truth that I learned recently. This is your idea.
Okay.
Even if you don't have a model.
Is it a truth or a law?
Even if you don't have a model and you're doing preventative things in security, that is functionally a prediction.
Yeah.
Like if you just fix a vulnerability and you just guessed, you have predicted that that vulnerability will become an event. Now you're probably wrong, but it would be much better if you had a data-driven prediction rather than a guess.
Yeah, and we get this a lot when we talk about modeling. People are like, well, tell us about false positives and your false negatives and do all this stuff. And I'm like, well, where are you now? Yeah, and everyone's like, oh,
No idea.
We aren't running models. I'm like, but you're doing things.
You're taking action, already, which
you have models running. They just may not be in code.
They're intuitive, it's
the baseline CSS is not GPT-4o and empirical and EPSS. The baseline is what you're doing now, and then everything else is either an improvement or not over that.
I have to say it. I love how much of a data scientist you are. Like, he's like, you're exerting effort. That means you're making a prediction. And you know what? You're probably wrong. And I could probably figure out how wrong, but can also tell you how right. And I love that so much. Yeah, that's fantastic.
I mean, that's the way the world works.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Awesome.
But that it also brings up sort of a tangent to talk about criticisms.
Yeah, right.
As people look at, say, something like EPSS, which is very public and used in a lot of different products, there's definitely critics out there that will try to point out flaws or something like that. And a lot of those critics have a very myopic view. And it brings up, there's that book, How to Lie with Statistics. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And it's like from the 60s or something.
There's lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Yeah. Yeah. And but in that book, it's basically talking about data viz techniques and the way that you can present data essentially to lie. And that book is a lot about poor data viz.
Tweak your y-axis, you're good.
But like if you know, we talked about the coverage and efficiency and things like that. And so if you want to critique this, you have to compare it to something. You know, like, hey, I developed this model and it's better because of the metrics, the coverage and efficiency metrics, the performance, the this and that. A lot of the critics are like, this is bad because I looked at this one thing and this one thing seemed wrong. You know, like seemed being an operative word, and it felt wrong. Like it doesn't seem like this is the way it should be. So this raises questions, you know, conspiracy theory.
I'm going to beg the question because.
Yeah. Even though they'll go a step further, right? I give them some credit, right? It's not just about something that feels, right? They'll cherry pick. Right? Sure. That would be like, here's a vulnerability that you said had a low likelihood of being exploited, and it was.
Yeah.
Therefore, this whole system is right. But that goes back to, in my mind, I mean, I've been in security a long time. Nihilism has existed forever, right?
Yeah, it's like, one of our defining traits in the industry. Yes.
And this is nothing new.
Yeah. Well, like, I would be really happy if someone said, hey, I started with EPSS and I found how it could be better. I would be like, that's awesome. You know, like, let's talk about that.
Yeah, to be fair, we've met people like that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like people in the EPSS do go a step further and try to use it to do combinatorial probability. Yeah.
I think we've all come to embrace it because every report we've launched, right?
Yeah.
No better way to crowdsource grammar and typo errors and errors in data sets, right? It's like go on the internet and explain something wrong if you want to get the right answer, right? But yeah, that's actually interesting. I've seen that quite a bit, right? People, especially with the known exploited vulnerabilities list from CISA, right? Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, they release a list. They started doing this 5 years ago?
Longer than that, I think.
Yeah, it's not been a super long time, but they started releasing a list of vulnerabilities that government agencies have been exploited within that subsegment, right? And it's driven a lot of like remediation talk, but it ignores a lot of the context around it, because attackers going after government institutions alone, like that's a massive data bias, right? Like,
And I want to give them credit though. I think that CISA Kev list has done a lot of good for the industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of good.
Absolutely.
And the challenge though is, and we see this in our own data set, that like when you go try to find the bad stuff, the internet is almost unfathomably huge. Anytime you go looking for something on the internet, you're taking a sample. You are getting a sample, you know? And so like you need statistics to deal with that sample. Sure. A lot of places will say like, hey, we went out and saw this bad stuff. And because we didn't see this bad stuff here, that's not happening. You know, and you're like, no, wait, you can't say that. Like you either know bad stuff happened or you don't know bad stuff happened. There is no bad stuff didn't happen, right? Yeah. And so you're always taking that sample.
Bad stuff didn't happen
Or that we know of, right?
So. Yeah, it's the vulns exploited or we don't know. It's not the vulns exploited or it's not.
Yeah.
Right.
And so it makes it hard to like correlate against some of this stuff.
So something like CISA Kev, like that's actually, I don't want to belittle what they're doing. I think they're doing a great job.
No, not at all, yeah.
But it is, you know, from what we've been able to collect, it is a rather small sample. And what's interesting, though, is that they still see things exploited that we don't. You know, we have, what are we?
Different samples.
12X or something? I don't know.
We have 17,200 as of yesterday. Because somebody asked me in a meeting yesterday, and I looked it up.
You looked it up. So, but like, you know, we're seeing 17,000 vulnerabilities being exploited, or we have seen that in the past. Yeah. And Sysakev is, I don't know, 1,400 or something like that. But and we still don't see everything that's on the Sysakev.
Yeah. Right, different samples.
Our sample is still not seeing everything, and we're, you know, 16x or whatever, I don't know, 12x, something like that. So it's always a sample, and you have to treat it like a sample.
Yeah, then I mean, that makes a ton of sense. And I will point out too, if you want to contribute and or criticize and or you know, ask questions, these guys are really, really active. Like, you can hit them up directly. You can go to the EPSS SIG, go to the meetings, right? You can actively participate. So I'd be remiss if I didn't call that out. Yeah. I mean, switching gears a little bit as well, because I think you could probably help audiences maybe vet some of the fake AI marketing, right? Like, if you're being sold something, you're shopping, and there's some good use cases for AI, there's a whole lot more bad ones. Do you guys have any advice for kind of like CISOs and or decision makers, like people, like when you're trying to evaluate solutions, what do you guys think about or look for to like kind of call bullshit on claims like AI?
Does someone else want to speak?
I'll start as always and let you guys actually say something smart.
Jay has a lot of thoughts here.
So, I mean, one of the biggest things for me and, yeah, when I was originally talking to these guys and decided this was something worth pursuing.
Because you joined recently, officially,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right? And so, yeah, I was originally talking about investing in these guys. And I'm like, actually, this is way too big of an opportunity to not be more of a part of it than that. And one of the things that I really love about, and we talked about it a little bit here with the transparency and things like that, but it's basically, how do you, to Jay's point, is like, how do you know how you're doing right now? Well, the same can be said of any new AI solution that's out there. How do you measure its success, right? And show me in numbers and data how that is successful. Because a lot of it is very hand wavy, right? That's out there. Now, there's some very legitimate AI use cases, as Jay and Michael talked about. It's very good at certain things, and certainly around language with the LLMs and stuff like that. But it's, how do you know, right? If I implement you today, and here's what I do today, and 30 days from now, what am I doing this differently, and how is that better, right? And I would guess that there's probably a lot of vendors on the show floor that either don't know or can't tell you.
Or look at this policy recommendation it just made.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is a lot of it is, it's not that they don't want to tell you, it's that they don't know. They just don't know the answer.
And I think I have a more general answer that you almost have to be literate yourself to be able to spot the BS. You know, so like if someone is describing that they're using AI and then they start talking about the reasoning that it's doing or something, you know, like some flag should go off and say like, hey, that's not what an LLM is. Or some people, AI is everything now. Anything data is AI. And so you'd want to try and understand exactly what they're doing, you know, and have the skill yourself to be able to see those red flags and to sniff out when someone is just full of it.
Yeah, there was actually,
so it's difficult.
At I think it was at Black Hat actually, and not to plug anybody else, but Caleb Sema and Edward Wu
had
a talk, and it was basically, here are the, I forget what it was, 5-7 things or whatever that you should be asking your new security AI provider to tell you to be able to call BS or not.
That sounds like a good session.
Yeah.
Go watch it. I'll try to link it if I can find the session in time. But
I think about this like a layer before it, which is, you're talking about tools. Let's first start with the problem we're trying to solve. And if that problem is measurable, we got to decide whether this tool is effective enough and actually moves the needle, and then see how much it costs too. So ultimately, you're making a purchasing decision, but it feels like sometimes we start with valorizing the tool rather than the problem that it solves and measuring the problem that it solves. which isn't really the way that anybody should be doing purchasing. We also do this. Like internally, when we build a model to solve a particular problem, of course we can throw it into ChatGPT and try to get an answer from it. But then we have to consider things like, how good is it at solving the problem? Can we measure the solution? Can we do something better and more efficient? So it's really the same thing that our customers are doing in their problems.
I have a half-written blog post I wanted to review, but we had a question come up where someone said, why do we need another scoring system? And I was like, at first I was like, what? Like, what kind of question is that? Like, and the reason that it surprised me is because like the way that we evaluate approaches now and evaluate things like AI is sort of gut feel. Like this industry is just almost 99% trust. You know, like you, and you're told as you're building a security company, you need to sell trust. You need to do that. But in data science, that doesn't exist. And in science in general, there is no trust. It's all like, all right, I think this is right. Now I need to go prove it. I need to go beyond a shadow of a doubt, show the data behind it, show how we got there. And so like when someone says, why do we need another scoring system? It's like, that's totally the wrong question. It's how does yours perform compared to everything else? Why is yours better?
Give Would you say metrics. You might need some empirical evidence to show
why? Yes.
Well, because it's all designed. It's for testing, validation, retesting, validation, right? Yeah. And that's the scientific method, and it's because things evolve.
It's
fundamentally,
it's the feedback
loop.
You know, so like if you don't have a feedback loop, how are you going to evaluate it?
I have a question for you.
Yeah, sure.
Is that allowed?
Yeah.
We're on the couch.
Yeah, why not? This is more of a love seat, but sure.
We had talked maybe a year ago, and you had said that in general, in marketing, there's been a decline in trust in science.
Yeah.
And we internally have been talking about that.
The trend, yeah.
Like, on the one hand, yes, that's true, that's a trend. On the other hand, you know, we talk to large banks and insurance providers, and they can't not trust science. They work with the data because that's how they make financial decisions.
Sure. Yeah.
So I'm kind of, I want to hear your opinion about security specifically. What does security, trust, and science look like today?
Whew. Trust and I think the biggest thing is transparency, right? Like it, one of the reasons we do the podcast, and I think we're trying to add value with like security.com, is because security vendors in general have treated solutions like a black box because it's going to help maintain competitive advantage and all that. But acquisitions, right? We're seeing the platformization of almost everything. So that's not really an excuse as much anymore, right? And we all know how hard it is to create like these models and then to measure them on the backside of that. There's not enough of that. And I think that's the reason that things are so opaque, because it's easier to sell magic than it is to sell science, right? And we were actually having this conversation. What's interesting about this, quantitatively, in terms of clicks, eyeballs, and also, you know, when you're doing marketing, simple is better. And we're watching that in short form video and TikToks, right? Having bold statements that are easy and intuitive to understand overrides everything else. It gets more looks, more clicks, more engagement. Explaining things with context and nuance, people tune out nowadays, and it requires more effort, and people don't listen as much.
Yeah, like an hour-long podcast. Who's going to watch that?
Yeah, well, and that's part of the reason we do that.
We are going to make a TikTok later, right?
I like, it's tempting. It's tempting to do TikTok, but I haven't ventured because TikTok is scary. But yeah, that's the hard part nowadays because simple is easier, and people are gravitating towards what's a little, it's more consumable, it's more intuitive.
There's value in it too. Like I understand reducing a problem down to its simplest parts because more people understand it.
It's the hardest thing to do.
At the same time, security of multinational corporations' technology infrastructure is not a simple problem. It is not that reducible.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's where the transparency comes in, because I think even being able to engage in the conversation and show your work, right? It's like math class, right? Like we're making an attempt and this is what we're doing, right? That goes a long way to being like, hey, you know, we want you to help to understand, but also to help like maybe call us and tell us how we can be better. Because that's what we should all really be striving on.
So
right?
This is why you have to show your work in math class. Now I know.
Yeah.
There we go, right? And so, I, you know, I I'm a big fan of transparency, and I think the more that we're able to have honest conversations and unveil, you know, talk about more of the real things that are going on behind the scenes, how we're measuring and why we think that's an improvement, that's where you're going to start to see things get better over time, I think.
There's a great analogy I heard. Someone described to me the how Nature academic articles in the Nature publication are structured. Like the first page of the article, everyone can read.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right? Everyone gets it. You get the message. You understand the first page. You go to the second page. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden you got to be a little bit more experienced in this field and stuff like that. By the time you get to the back of the article, you're down to like 2% of the audience that's going to understand what's in the back of it.
Yes.
And that's the way these articles are structured. They're structured like everybody gets it. Now you come in, you can do a little bit more, a little deeper, a little more detail. And that's, I think, how we're structured. Like people are going to come in, hopefully, and see, you know, get the initial message and then have more detailed questions and we're going to be there.
So I
right.
Well, hey, when we worked on the research reports, right? What was the thing that I drove primarily? The one page executive summary.
Yeah.
Right?
I was thinking about those executive summaries.
I'm like, how do we get the simple, like, this is the story at a high level that someone who has 5 minutes to take the time to read can read. And then the people who want to dig deeper, they go in and here's our homework, right? And you can, if you've got the skills and the inclination to go do that, to listen to the entire podcast, right? You can really get the full context. And then you can decide for yourself if you think we're right, wrong, or could be improved, right? And I think the world needs a lot more of that. And I like the way that's structured because it is really the best of both worlds, right? We have these insights, but you can go check how we got there if you're so inclined. If not, power to you.
Well, even on the product side, right? I mean, that's an old adage is you design for the novice and configure for the expert, right?
Yeah.
Everybody is going to be able to do something and do whatever the job they need to do.
Yeah.
And for those who need to see all the evidence, all the detailed data underneath the hood, they still can, right?
I was laughing because everybody can understand what Ed says. Like, you go a little deeper to understand what I say, and then like 2% of people know what Jay's talking about.
I love it, and it's hilarious too, because Michael, you're really like, we have conversations, and it's the intersection of like practical application of the most complex shit you've ever heard of, and then it evolves into philosophy every time.
I am still thinking about the vastness of the internet ocean that Jay samples with his fishing net.
Man. Ultimately, I think that's actually probably a pretty good place to stop for today. But I think there's a lot of pressure on security teams to adopt AI to stay relevant, right? Like VC, right? That's how you go get money and all that nowadays. But I think you guys are kind of the case of not chasing the trend, but really setting it in a lot of ways. And the way you guys have like developed both the companies, to be quite honest, about bringing kind of clarity to risk is the ultimate goal, which I reduce uncertainty. And that's what I love about you guys. So ultimately, that's a wrap for security.com, the podcast. Big thanks to Ed, Michael, Jay. And anything you guys want to let the audience know before we sign off?
Well, you can come check out some of this research we've been talking about, empiricalsecurity.com. We've got a blog that hangs off of there under the research section, including all of the fun LLM experiments that we did and benchmarking that we did there as well.
We could probably do a guest post for you guys on the security.com blog if you want. Yeah, awesome. So check out more insights and technical deep dives like their research on empiricalsecurity.com and also security.com. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share the show with your fellow defenders. Thanks for listening. And remember, stay sharp, stay curious, and stay human.